It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back to a discussion of classic films. This is episode 57, Sweet Smell of Success. Sweet Smell of Success from 1957, a film directed by Alexander McKendrick, based on a novel by Ernest Lehman and a screenplay by Clifford Odets, starring Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis, but also starring this evening are my panelists, who I shall introduce to you now, beginning with Nathan Alderman. Hello.
Hi. Someone just handed me a cookie full of arsenic. Do you think I should take a bite out of it?
No, don't do it. Next up, Randy Dittinga. Hi.
Well, I have this cat in a bag and the bag's in the river. And I'm wondering if I should call the Humane Society.
So much indecision this evening. Philip Michaels, are you indecisive as well?
No. We got a regular Chico Hamilton quintet here, so I'm very, very excited.
I'm playing the snare, or the cymbals, actually. And last, but certainly not least, it's David J. Lohr. Hello.
I guess that makes me Martin Milner. I mean, sure. It's plausible.
Why not? Call you Martin Milner. One of two future TV actors that we'll meet in this film.
Yeah, you were great in Adam 12. That was fantastic.
Yeah. And David White, Larry Tate from Bewitched.
I know, I said two TV actors. I was ready.
He's uncredited, too.
I know. Isn't that weird? And also, he's a creep.
He's so lecherous.
Well, Sweet Smell of Success, a film that didn't do well at its opening, but has gone up in the estimation of film historians over the years, is a delightful, charming story of a man who is very
fun terrible for the family.
Of a terrible man who is playing a thinly veiled and not even so veiled clone of Walter Winchell and his press agent buddy hanger on. Boyfriend? I don't know. We could talk about that stuff as well.
Interested in his sister.
I think both.
Yeah.
Honestly, yeah. If I'm being really honest.
There's a lot of subtext there.
J.J. Hunsaker has a lot of appetites in this movie that I think we'll be discussing.
Yes. So we have Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis in this film. And interestingly, we have two leads whose characters are quite despicable. And people didn't want Tony Curtis to do this part because he was sort of a pretty boy. And it's like you have this guy who's the press agent who is quite terrible. And Burt Lancaster, happy to play terrible because, you know, apparently he was. To talk a little bit about the sort of basis for the movie, Walter Winchell was a big deal columnist who had the ability to make or break careers. He was also fiercely anti-communist and reveled in taking people down with innuendo about not only their sex lives and all that normal sort of stuff, but communism as well. Remember, we're in the late 50s now. He's been a big deal since the 30s. He had a radio show, but mostly he was known for his column, and he was the dean of Broadway columnists, I guess. And Ernest Lehman, who wrote the story on which this is based, actually worked as a press agent. So I guess he was sort of in the Tony Curtis role for who interacted with another Broadway columnist in the late 40s and ended up writing this based on his experience. The press agent about whom, or the columnist about whom he wrote, hated his guts for a year and a half. And then after a year and a half said, you know what? I'm going to write a nice squib and a column about you, and I'm going to turn you into a big deal screenwriter, which he did. And so Ernest Lehman became the screenwriter of such things as The King and I and West Side Story and Sound of Music and not all musicals. Those are all the ones I thought
of.
North West. A lot of Hitchcock stuff I was going to say.
Right.
Yep.
And so by the time this movie comes out, this is kind of his project. He didn't end up, he was originally potentially going to direct it. He didn't end up doing that. He didn't even finish writing it. He kind of went crazy because he didn't get along with Burt Lancaster or some of the other people.
I mean, who did?
And, right. Not difficult. And so Clifford Odets, who was a playwright and a screenwriter of long standing, he's responsible for most of this crackling dialogue that we'll be talking about in the film.
And ironically, he had been in trouble for his communist leanings.
Yes.
And was shunned by Hollywood for naming names.
Yeah, he named names, exactly. But he'd been around since the 30s as a pretty openly left-leaning guy and then got in trouble in the 50s. So this movie, as I say, didn't do very well when it came out, but has since risen in the estimation of film historians. And it's directed by this guy, Alexander McKendrick, who's a Scot, and he had directed some comedies before. He hadn't really done a lot of Hollywood things. He did a few things later, but this is kind of his big deal movie, and it's very uncharacteristic of the other things that he did. And so
I was really shocked looking at his resume going, oh, he did The Lady Killers. This is nothing like The Lady Killers.
Right.
He was one of the main people at Ealing Studios, and he handled all those comedies.
The Lady Killers has that same like pitch black vein running through it. So
yeah, that is true.
It is acidic.
And that is certainly something that carried through to this movie.
Yeah, probably a lot of credit to that goes to Clifford Odets. I can't really get a sense of. I mean, McKendrick really did take over as director. Lehman didn't get all that far with it. He got further, I think, in writing the screenplay than he did in the idea of him directing the film. But McKendrick directs, and Odets basically keeps the shell of the story, but rearranges and rewrites everything. So all of those, like I say, there's so much dialogue in this that it's extremely quotable, and I'm glad we got through some of it, and we'll get through more. all Odets.
They hired him because they thought, we'll get through this in like 2 or 3 weeks, and we'll have the script to shoot. It'll be great. And he took 4 months.
4 months.
Seriously reconstructing everything. But thank God he did, because it is way better than Lehman's original prose.
It's interesting that they let him do that, because it was one of those movies that a lot of people didn't want to see made. I mean, Lehman got it made eventually, because he wrote this in the late 40s, and he tried to get it done, and Hollywood didn't really want to do it. Lancaster, through his production company, ended up producing it. He wanted to do it. So whatever you want to say about Burt Lancaster, and you can say lots of things about him, he did want to get this movie made.
And he has a history of that.
Yes, we will, even if we have to, you know, do horrible things to everybody else, I suppose. But let me stop the sort of dissertation part of this. Have you all seen this movie before? Are you familiar with it? Was it new to anyone?
It wasn't new to me, but I didn't know the history, and I assumed this had been a play because it's very dialogue heavy and it seems like a movie that was really stage bound, and they opened it up, and it makes sense because Clifford Odets adapted it, and it does at some points seem stagey, like it pulls me out a little bit because of the dialogue is so unrealistic. it's that kind of, I'm kind of divided in this. I love some of the dialogue, but some of it is just a little too much.
It's funny that you should mention the staginess, because it became a musical long ago.
2003, I think.
A disastrous musical that basically won John Lithgow a Tony because people said, hey, that's John Lithgow. We should give him an award. But it's not a very good musical, and I believe it lost a ton of money.
It lost
Max Biehl stock ton of money.
It lost $10 million, its entire capitalization. It had a score by Marvin Hamlisch, which that's a strange blend of material and artist.
It is.
And then a book by John Guare, which...
It's a really strange mixture.
Really strange. I mean, he did weird things to Kiss Me, Kate when they brought it back in the early 2000s, I think. Mm-hmm. And I never liked his revision of that, but then I got a glimpse at this, and I went, oh, that's why that died. Okay, because I never got a chance to see it. It closed that quickly.
But to answer Shelley's question, this is the second time I've seen this movie. I have seen it before. It's not one I go back to often because it's an off-putting movie in thematically and with the characters. So it's a good movie, but it's not one that you gather around the family for, as I mentioned at the outset.
I was thinking about it's the way it looks at show business is being full of this moral rot. And I was thinking about all these other movies in the 50s that had the same message, All About Eve, Sunset Boulevard, A Star Is Born, Bad and the Beautiful, that painted show business in such this dark light. And I'm trying to think of movies, from the last couple of decades that have been have really ripped up show business. And I couldn't. Could you guys think of anything that's similar? Well, to
Showgirls.
No. The Player.
No.
Player. Caesar. The Player. But well, yeah, that was nothing.
Star is like 30 years ago. Which, was also of that time and of our more recent time.
Yeah.
And also A Star Is Born. From 1977
too.
And from 1937, so a few.
So all the decades. Well, and the Big Knife is another one, which actually Lehman wrote. So, which and as somebody is, I read something today. What this movie did for a columnist, the Big Knife does for screenwriting, and basically skewers it. And is
no, I've seen this a few times. I love how acid black it is. And I mean, once I watched it specifically for a theater people making film project to focus on Odette's, it's a film I love to look at. It is a sumptuous black and white film. It's all shot in New York. And it's wonderful to see 1950s New York looking like that. It reminds me of The Naked City in some ways, both the movie and the TV series, which is actually pretty well shot for a late 50s TV show. And but this is just, I mean, you've got James Wong Howe, so of course it's going to look good. And, and it's hard to watch because, man, Burt Lancaster is scary. And apparently he was in real life. They just sort of used that.
It's a movie that's not kind to any of the female characters.
Yeah.
Nobody is treated. They're both of the female characters who have significant parts are treated terribly by each of the men involved.
And the secretaries and assistants too. Mm-hmm. They're all. The only person who is remotely decent is probably the jazz guitarist played by Martin Milner.
Steve Dallas.
And Steve Dallas. Very honest. Very, very earnest. I mean, oh my goodness. Well, Nathan, how about you? We haven't heard
he
that.
He had a penguin that he lived with, and it was just a strange thing.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
This is another one of those Netflix film school titles for me. I first and only saw it about 20 years ago. So it's another one where I sort of remembered the first half and almost nothing of the second half. But yeah, the cinematography, I could eat with a spoon. And I think that's that's why this movie works as well as it does, because it is both beautiful and starkly ugly in equal measure and somehow manages to be both at the same time. But I can't imagine why 1957 America wasn't ready for a movie that said your institutions and your heroes are morally bankrupt. Hey, look, here's two of the most incredibly attractive men we have on Earth at this time, and they are both absolute dirtbags.
America, your newspaper columnists are horny all the time.
And I mean, hadn't Winchell already fallen by this point? Because he was on the verge
No.
When was that?
This kind of precipitated it.
He was overjoyed when the movie bombed.
In fact, when it had its New York premiere, he sent like his minions to go and like badmouth it in the lobby afterwards. And yeah, he was super happy that it bombed.
Because I'm trying to remember when he wound up narrating The Untouchables, because that was kind of like
late 50, early 60, like 60, 61, something like that. Right. Yeah, so if you want to if you want to get a small sense of Walter Winchell, just listen to his Untouchables narration, just because his voice, and it, like I say, he had a radio show, and I forget what his tagline, something of good evening, good, America, and all the ships at sea,
good evening,
it's time to go to press.
Good evening,
like
Mr.
that.
And Mrs. America, and all the ships at sea. Yeah.
But yeah, everything I've read indicates that this movie did sort of precipitate his fall, which surprises me a little bit, because in order for that to happen, it seems like people would have had to internalize this movie in the way that you would a movie that was a hit. And it wasn't a hit. And it's also a movie that's really, the dialogue, it's sort of elevated. It's not like Face in the Crowd, where you can look at that guy and go, oh, he's terrible. Let's never have politicians like that. Oh, oops. Right. But this movie, you kind of have to be paying attention. And so it's interesting that it precipitated as well. I mean, Winchell was getting older and had been around for long enough that perhaps he was due for a fall anyway. And the worst of the red baiting was starting to abate by then. And he was all about the red baiting.
Yeah.
So we have this wonderful combination of beautiful cinematography, the tremendous score by Elmer Bernstein, which I just love. I mean, the combination of the photography and the score to me just make it. And I'm somebody who I sometimes do have a low tolerance for movies where all of the dialogue is just hard and mean and aggressive. But for some reason, I love this. I really I wouldn't watch it every day by any means. It's been some time since I've seen this, but it's just the quips, it's just so well done. And it's like, it's a ballet, it's a dance. It's just the movement of the film and the way all the performers, especially Curtis and Lancaster, and it really is, their parts are so much bigger than anybody else in the movie. Interestingly, you don't see Lancaster for like the first 25 minutes. And so Curtis's movie, and he's freaking out and he's talking about J.J. Hunsaker, who is Lancaster's character, and he's talking about these things he has to do for him, but we haven't even seen him yet. And so there's this buildup of suspense, and then you see him, and then it's like, oh, it's on now.
And it's really good. It's like The Third Man, where there's so much talk about Harry Lime in that people think, oh, Orson Welles was in the whole movie. No, he's in it for like 4 minutes, right? And in this, it's building up J.J. Hunsaker. I mean, the first thing you see is the truck with his, you know, go with the globe. Everybody reads The Eyes of Broadway, right? And it's like, you have 20, 22 minutes of everybody's afraid of this guy. Everybody's trying to get in with this guy. This guy has all the power. Nothing else is going on in the movie but people being afraid of J.J. Hunsaker.
And that's finally pronounced Hudsucker.
Well, I was going to say, you have the Hunsucker proxy in here.
Right.
But, you know, when you finally hear him, you don't even see him at first. But you have the iconic voice of Burt Lancaster, who was, of course, a huge star at that point. So you know what he looks like. And when you finally do see him, he's got these, you know, straight across wire-rimmed brow glasses. And they're shooting from below, and the light is from above, so he's got the shadow of the glasses, and he's just got this, it's almost like this godlike power because of the way they've built him up, that he's just scary.
Burt Lancaster was a large man with a large head, but the shooting style and the glasses just really accentuate.
He looks like an Easter Island statue. No,
he looks like
an evil
Clark Kent.
He does. Mm. He does.
He looks quite a bit older than he is, too. I think he was, what was it, about, so this was 57. So about 44 at that time. And he looks, you know, well over 50 and like he's been around and just toughened by life, hardened.
There's an incredible stillness to his performance. You've got, on one hand, you've got the manic, wiry energy of Tony Curtis, who is great. Tony Curtis in this movie is a man standing in an open grave, and from moment one of the film, dirt is being shoveled down on top of him, and he is trying to talk his way out of the burial. And you know, there's a fascination to that. Even though you know he is going to end up 6 feet under, it is fascinating to watch him try. But you take all that rangy, manic, desperate, sweaty energy from Tony Curtis, and you balance it against the absolute terrifying stillness and the ramrod control that Lancaster brings to Hunsaker. And what a combination.
And that's what makes him so scary.
My one problem with the movie is actually a little bit Tony Curtis, because I don't believe that you have to like the main characters of the movie, but you have to at some level root for them or be, oh no, he's not going to get away with it. And the movie that I think of while watching this is Ace in the Hole with Kirk Douglas. Kirk Douglas is every bit as reprehensible as Tony Curtis is in this movie in Ace in the Hole, but because he has that Kirk Douglas charm, you're all, oh, he's terrible, but I kind of hope that he doesn't. Oh, yeah. He's not gonna. Whereas Tony Curtis, you're all, I want him to die. And maybe that's just my own personal reaction to Tony Curtis, knowing what kind of person he was. But if there's something that keeps me from getting fully invested in the movie, it's a little bit of that character never really gives you a chance to hope that he gets out of that grave and brushes off the dirt being shoveled on him.
Well, it's funny because at the time he was only known as a likable actor. They didn't have we didn't know about Tony Curtis at that point.
Sure.
And yeah. So, you know, it was like, okay, well, I guess we're rooting for him. And now, you know, we watch it and go, no, I mean, I grew up in a house that did not like Tony Curtis. So I had the Stockholm syndrome of, oh, he's kind of creepy. Well, what's interesting is when they did the musical version, you know, you've got John Lithgow as Hunsaker, which is I can kind of see it.
It's and a choice.
Young Brian D'Arcy James, who is a really good actor. This is one of his earlier Broadway roles. He's playing the Sidney Falco role. And again, he's a nice, he really works as a nice guy character. And they needed way more plot than is in the movie. So that's part of the problem with the show. But at the end of the show, instead of just getting beaten up by the cop, oh, I spoiled the movie. Sorry.
Oopsie.
If you're listening to this, you've seen it, I hope.
Watch the damn movie.
But in the musical, he's surrounded by the New York cop and his other cop buddies. And then you just get this sort of news flash as you're watching Hunsaker go off on his next morning. And Sidney Falco was found dead by the New York City police. Mm. And it's like, it's a bit much.
At the end of this movie, he gets dragged away, and there is no guarantee that these police officers' violence against him ended with him in a crumpled heap on the sidewalk.
Right. But this trusts the audience to make that decision, right? Whereas the musical just goes, nope, we're going to make every decision for you.
So when I wrote up the description so we could watch this movie, I wrote something about how I thought Lancaster was good and that Tony Curtis was less good, and it's because I hadn't seen the movie in a long time, and so I enjoyed Curtis in this movie this time. Yeah, I suffer from the same sort of reflexive negative reaction to Tony Curtis as a human, but I liked him in the movie, and I also think because the way we're conditioned to watch movies, I would say especially in this period, but I would argue in general, the expectation is that the Tony Curtis character at some point is going to have a moral breakthrough and he's going to say, bite me, Hunsaker, I'm not doing your bidding. And he doesn't really do that.
He has 5 whole seconds of ethics.
Right. Yeah. So there's a long period during the movie where you're giving him a little bit more of the benefit of the doubt. And I'm sure audiences of that era were too, because he was so much so regarded as a pretty boy and a light comedian and all that stuff. And so people are like, okay, well, Tony Curtis is either going to be the moral center of the movie and take Hunsaker down, or at the very least, he's going to tell him no, and he doesn't do it, which I absolutely agree with. I think that's what the movie totally should have done. But it's kind of fascinating, and it just makes you think about what your expectations as a movie viewer are. When you are presented lead characters, one is good, one is bad, right? That's how it's supposed to work.
Right.
Yeah, it's really interesting that instead here we get bad and absolute nightmare. Like the reason Sidney Falco works as a protagonist is that he doesn't have the power. He's lacking the power. He's the underdog. And so you can kind of root for his attempt to like climb the ladder just because he's opposite J.J. Hunsaker, who is so terrifying and godlike. But yeah, he's my problem with the movie is Steve Dallas, who is an interesting character on the page. But then you cast Martin Milner, who, again, like John Lund in No Man of Her Own, he's got a big side of beef energy.
Bobby Blandino is what I call him.
And if you had a dynamic actor who really popped off the screen, who could hold his own against those two, that would be interesting. It would have been really interesting if he'd been black, because it's weird to have the Chico Hamilton quartet fronted by a black man. And then they're like, but actually, it's this white guy. He's the amazing guitarist.
Now, it was originally supposed to be Robert Vaughn, who probably would have popped a lot more against Curtis and Lancaster, but then he got drafted.
Yeah.
Well, and I think one of the weaker scenes for me is the point at which they're at the TV studio and there's the confrontation, and you have Dallas there and you have Hunsaker there, and they're talking about whether he's going to stick with Susie or not, or whether he's going to leave. And there's a lot of great dialogue in that scene, but I feel like Dallas says things, and he says things that are earnest and that are, you know, he basically is like, I'm, you know, not going to suck up to you. But I think a better actor with a little more confidence could have made that scene work better, because I just think there's too much going on in it, and it's too clever by half. There's too much sort of, okay, what is everybody trying to get out of this scene, and how does what happens in the scene change those dynamics? And I think the weak link there, because that's a really complicated dialogue scene, and I think you could argue that it's overwritten, but I also think you could argue that Steve Dallas and the Susie character are both written in such a way that not only can they never come out on top, which we know they won't, but they can't really hold their own as performers, and so it's hard to watch them.
I don't want to presume to give Ernest Lehman and Clifford Odette's notes, but
oh, go ahead.
Oh, why not?
Go ahead.
Were I to make a suggestion on this movie, I think not enough attention is paid to Susie's complicity with her brother's way of doing things, so that she is very happy to reap the rewards with the fur coats and the living on Broadway, and every door is open to her and every opportunity is there with her. Oh, I don't like that you're mean to my boyfriend. I think in the hands of a more fully fleshed out character and perhaps a slightly better actor in that part, you'd have a more she'd be less of a cipher in the movie and less of a bystander and more of an active participant. That I'm making out like I don't enjoy this movie, and I do enjoy this movie, but there are we are obviously tackling the flaws of Sweet Smell of Success.
Can I stick up for Susie?
Go ahead.
I mean, I really liked Susan Harrison's performance. She does not look like a movie star, and that absolutely works. And I think Susie's an interesting character because I don't feel like she's enjoying any of these things. She is a prisoner. That fur coat is too large for her by half, and she slouches around in it. She doesn't strut or wear it proudly. She slouches around like it's some terrible weight. And I like that in the end, like, she wins. And what I want to know is, what do you guys think? So obviously at the end of the movie, she calls Sydney over, says she's planning to kill herself and have him take the blame for it with JJ. But do you think that, like, her actual plan was to make it look like he was trying to attack her? Was that her long game the whole time?
It's very ambiguous. No. Ambiguous what her if the suicide attempt was fake, and she invited Sydney over to kind of expose him and humiliate him. You wonder why did she call him? What was, if she's going to kill herself, why does she call him? Just to punish him by making him watch it, or is she have? She seems like there's a couple close-ups of her that make it look like she's quite a bit sneakier than she lets on at toward the very end of the movie.
Her room in that amazing apartment, the production design in this movie, my God.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Her room is tiny. It is like a prison cell, and it goes out onto a balcony where JJ can watch her at all times. So yeah, this is not even a woman living in a gilded cage. She's just in a cage. That fur coat isn't there for her to enjoy. That fur coat is there so JJ can say to himself, look how well I take care of my sister, everybody.
And from that giant picture
he has of her on his desk, he would like to take care of his sister really well.
I mean, she if you watch the way she tries to scramble over the edge of the balcony, she gets awfully close. I mean, that's not just, hey, I'm pretending. Oh, yeah, you'll pull me back. You know, now, was that the actor? Was that what they intended? I don't know. But it's a little weird. And, you know, again, you know, maybe a stronger actress, maybe stronger focus on the character. That would be an interesting idea. Was it intentional? Was she trying to set him up? It's hard to say. Although there is a nice moment where when Hunsucker comes in and says, you know, if he's telling the truth about this, then he's telling the truth just as much as you're telling the truth about not killing yourself. And she realizes, ah, but yes, I did try to kill myself. So he's probably telling the truth too. Right. It's an interesting turn there. And you can see it. You do actually have a moment where you see her thinking that while he's looking at the camera and looking away from her. And I like that. So I don't know how intentional it was in terms of a setup.
She's also supposed to be 19, which is accurate for the actress, but she reads older to me. And I think that there are ways that her being 19 could have either played into sort of her ambiguous attitude toward how her life is going and her inability to sort of get out of it until the end. But I don't know exactly what I would have wanted. Maybe I just want a different actor, because I don't really see the script on the page. Again, I just don't think the women characters get nearly enough opportunity to do what they should be able to do.
But I will stick up for one of a female character in the movie and one female performance. Rita, the cigarette girl, Barbara Nichols, she's great.
She's great. Yes. I think what happens to the character is terrible.
It's a terrible thing.
It's a
that
really good performance.
But she breaks your heart, and she is out of the movie by act one, but you think about her constantly, just with the way that she's betrayed by Sydney and used by every horrible newspaper columnist in New York. It turns out
she already knew the guy and had already maybe had a previous fling with the guy.
Basically, she's forced to prostitute herself and your protagonist,
to Larry Tate.
Yeah, to Larry Tate.
And
the guy you're supposed to sympathize with is the pimp in this situation. So you're all, eee!
And poor Sally, the receptionist, who is, you know, Sydney's like constantly negging her without even, like, so pickup artists neg because they at least want to get with the person that they are negging. This is a terrible practice. They are terrible human beings. I do not wish to imply endorsement in any way. But Tony Curtis isn't even doing that. He is just negging her to make her feel bad. He is just like, she's like the puppy that he keeps around to kick. Like, he even calls her on, like, being needy and vulnerable. Oh, you are trying to show care and affection for me. That makes you a terrible person. Wow. It's
People
just brutal.
And kind of sick.
And Jeff Donnell has, again, that's her name. Jeff Donnell has that great, like, not a movie star face where she shrinks into herself and looks so kind of haunted and vacant in really fascinating and poignant ways.
You know, you think of puppy dog looks as being man, but she may be one of the few actresses that can do that.
So let's talk about the photography a little bit. I think, Nathan, you were the one who was most vocal in our earlier conversations about James Wong Howe's work. But I think we can all agree, beautiful movie. I should say quickly that the way to see it, if you want to see it at its absolute best, is there's a Criterion Blu-ray. Which the reviews, I haven't seen it, but the reviews of the transfer are excellent. That Blu-ray also comes with a big book and a lot of extras. The book includes the original novella on which this is based, as well as a few essays about the film and there's commentary on the movie. So if you're into discs and if you're into this movie specifically, the Criterion Blu-ray is particularly worthy. But what do you want to say about the cinematography?
That is the version I saw, and I am into this movie. So, you know, it is well worth getting if you are into the movie.
Yes. Also, if you don't want to splash out just for that, it is available in HD on Amazon Prime. And wow, does that transfer. Maybe the Blu-ray looks even nicer since it's uncompressed. But there's a scene at the theater where JJ is rehearsing his TV show, and he appears in profile with his face in shadow. And the crispness is just delectable. My God. It's James Wong Howe and Conrad Hall, man. Those two guys, maybe the best cinematographers, at least in black and white, who ever lived.
I will second the Amazon Prime version. I've been burned by Amazon Prime before, and it's and it's bad prints of movies. See Suddenly, where they blur out the cigarettes that people are smoking on screen. But this one is pretty pristine. If you don't want to splash out for the Blu-ray, or if you don't live near a Revival movie house that's showing this on the big screen.
I believe there are actual cigarettes in this movie.
It's actually free on Amazon Prime as we're taping this. And I agree mm-hmm. with everybody else. I saw the blacks were so just dark and scary in this movie.
And there's a lot of darkness because a lot of this takes place at night. Apparently it was shot in the winter. So there's a lot of rain slicked streets. You don't see snow or anything like that, but you do see sort of a dark darkness. A lot of New York exteriors. It was shot in New York, even in the interiors. I don't know. I do. Is this less a thing in the by the time of the 50s? But I always thought it was funny in the 30s and 40s when you would see nightclubs and they were so brightly lit, mostly in, you know, to be fair, in musicals and comedies and stuff like that. But this gives the sense of a place one goes at night. This movie does largely happen at night. There are things that happen during the day, but the sort of business of the movie is transacted primarily in bars and nightclubs and jazz clubs and on the streets of New York and in cabs. And so it creates an atmosphere that holds throughout the movie, and that both the cinematography and the quality of the video versions that we can now see just really make it beautiful to watch.
And knowing New York the way I do, I loved seeing it shot so beautifully in that period, and mm-hmm. and seeing things that I recognized from when I was there that aren't there anymore now, and especially like the old Howard Johnson's that's down near the Brill Building,
which is where J.J. Hunsaker lives,
and they don't specify it, but that's the whole TV sequence, that's the Ed Sullivan Theater today.
Really?
Oh, is it?
It is.
Oh,
it's at 54th and Broadway. And as soon as I saw the street sign, I went, oh, that's where his TV show is. And and sure enough, you know, when you all the shots looking out in the audience, and I'm like, yeah, that's the Ed Sullivan Theater. Which I was there for a Letterman taping. I've been there for a Colbert taping. If you can go to a Colbert taping, it is gorgeous. They've done a beautiful job restoring and, you know, giving it its full glory. They had covered up a lot of it through the 70s and 80s. Like they filmed Kate and Ally there for 5 years. They filmed the $10,000 Pyramid and other game shows there. And so it stayed mostly covered up when they bought it and renovated it for Letterman. And Colbert was like, no, I want the full glory from when it was the Hammerstein Theater in the 20s. And it's just gorgeous. This has been New York Architecture, a segment.
I'm into it. I'm totally into it.
I didn't even propose a segment, and I did a segment.
Well, if you propose a segment, I'll tell you can't do it. But if you just do it, I'll probably not notice. And then later on, I'll put a chapter marker in and voila, it's a segment.
So I'm curious what you guys think about JJ and his sister.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
The giant photo on his desk says everything you need to know. JJ is all about repression.
Flowers in the attic, Broadway style.
you've broken up with Martin Milder. Now let me kiss your cheek very, very platonically.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean,
that's the thing that I love is the moment that you absolutely see the person JJ is beneath the mask comes when he's telling Tony Curtis after that showdown in the theater, we have to destroy him. And then we have to destroy Steve Dallas. He says, and he justifies it by saying, it's not me, you understand. It's my 60 million readers. And it's like, okay, I have your number now, dude. You are hiding behind this facade and you are maintaining this rigid control because underneath you're just a scumbag like Tony Curtis.
It's hard to tell if it's a sexual interest he has in her or kind of like Clifton Webb and Laura, where it's like a kind of sense of obsessive control, or even in All About Eve with Addison DeWitt and Eve. And there's another situation where you're like, I don't think that he really has a sexual interest, but he wants he's obsessed and wants to control her.
Oh, I think the control is a sublimation of his desire to have sex with her, because, you know, she is radiating trauma. You know, they mention her being like delicate and everything, but no, she is like broadcasting every moment she's on screen. She is silently screaming. And I think that's because, like, she, whether she consciously knows it or not, she is absolutely picking up on those vibes. She does not feel safe anywhere, you know, that around this guy or anywhere he can reach.
I was thinking of other examples of movies at this time that hinted at incest. There is a Desert Fury where they hint that Mary Astor is Lisbeth Scott's mother. And there's a little hint that there's more than the usual motherly affection. And then I also thought of Angela Lansbury in Manchurian Candidate with her son and the way, you know, just the way that they hinted this so delicately that you watch it, you're like, is that really going on, or am I just making it up?
No, she has way more chemistry with him than she does with James Gregory.
Oh, 100%.
Even though she was only like 9 years older than Lawrence Harvey.
Yeah.
But that is like Angela Lansbury's whole career, just messing around with age dynamics. And, you know, good on her. That was great.
There's a Claude Rains movie where he's a Hunsucker, like a newspaper columnist who murders someone.
Yes.
There's like a family ties are very loose and interchangeable there. And I forget the name of the movie.
Is it The Unforgiven?
It's like late 40s. I've seen it, but I can't remember.
Unsuspected.
That's
the
one.
Yes.
Yep.
It's really creepy. And Claude Rains does his usual creepy job. You don't really know how evil he is. He's a scary guy through the movie, but you don't find out he's a murderer until later in the movie, which I think really works, and it's a really good one.
And do we think that JJ has a thing for Sydney?
I think he wants to dominate Sydney. Yeah. I think whatever that means.
Yeah, again, similar to his sister, I think his kink, as it were, is control. He wants people to step two. And I think with Sydney, he gets a very willing partner.
Match me.
Yeah, Sydney. Right. Sydney.
It's all narcissist and control and domination. And you all pay attention to me. And that's
it. And Sydney bucks against that, but he also seems to relish it. Like, he says he doesn't like it, but he just jumps in way too avidly.
Because he's trying to be on the inner circle. There are a lot of people like Sydney trying to get attention from Hunsucker. And Sydney is the one who, by doing his bidding, and because he travels around with him. Like, there are multiple scenes where they're moving around the city together. And I presume that most of the people who are sycophants for Hunsucker and want something from him don't actually have the opportunity that Sydney does. And so it may be miserable for Sydney on some level, but he's got access that a lot of people don't.
Well, and he, you know, Hunsucker can recognize that he is a very similar type. And, you know, maybe this is a protege. Maybe this is someone to inherit his column. Who knows?
But I don't think Sydney has the capacity to become Hunsucker, even if he wanted to be.
No.
I mean, he doesn't. Even the brutality that he shows is 100% there. He doesn't have the control. He doesn't have the stillness like Nathan was talking about earlier, either in performance, which obviously wouldn't be appropriate, or in terms of the character. He's
twitchy.
He's always going to... He's very twitchy. He's always going to be a pretender.
He's like a loose electrical cable just sort of sparking and twitching the whole time.
And when he mistreats Rita, he's not taking any pleasure out of it. It is simply a means to an end. He is not... JJ would do that for the delight in watching Rita squirm and suffer. Sydney is barely registering that Rita feels anything because he is just thinking, okay, this chess move gets me here, and then that gets me here, and that gets me here. You know, so...
Which is why he treats Susie the way he does and says the terrible things he does to her, because he doesn't have empathy or understanding of the perspective of the person who is in his way or making it so that or protesting the thing that he wants to happen. It's the same thing.
You can tell he feels bad that he's setting up Steve Dallas at the end of the movie and he doesn't like Kello at all. So he at least has that guilt, but it never stops him. You know, he's just going to feel bad about himself and then like move on with his life and focus on on, you know, whatever he gets out of it. That's why he's getting drunk with his buddies. It's not because he's happy. It's because he's trying not to be sad. So that is the tiniest glimmer of any kind of spark of anything resembling decency in him. But yeah, JJ is just, you know, for JJ, it's personal. For Sydney, it's not. It's never personal because other people aren't people to him. They're just things he can maneuver. And, you know, that's true for JJ, too. They're not people. They're just ants. But at least for JJ, JJ likes getting out the magnifying glass and watching those ants burn.
Right. For Sydney, they're an inconvenience because they're between him and his goal, whatever it is. And especially women, because, I mean, there are all sorts of other, like Steve Dallas, and there are other people in the movie that Sydney has to either step over or get around. But the women, I think what he says to Susie about this sort of terrible generalizations he makes about women, I think he believes that stuff. I think he believes that women operate, what was it, you're thinking with your hips, right? Women operate on a different plane, and they cannot be understood by... They don't operate in a way that a male can understand and manipulate in the way that he would like to. And so he just, you know, lashes out.
I like that Susie unambiguously wins, that the end of the movie and the happy ending belongs to her.
Yeah.
And that she, you know, whether through luck and just taking advantage of circumstances as they arise or careful planning, she wins in the end. She plays Hunsucker, she plays Sydney, and then she gets out.
And they don't belabor it, but if you notice, as she leaves the Brill Building and goes walking down the street and the music rises and the end comes up, it's maybe the only really sunny moment in the movie. There's sunlight.
Yeah, it's sunrise, yeah.
Yeah.
It's morning, yeah.
There are daytime scenes, but yeah, they don't look as hopeful as that one.
Right,
right,
right.
So there is one other female actress that we haven't mentioned, and I noticed that she is the only person in this movie that seems to still be alive. And she is the singer at the table with the senator. The character's name was Linda James, and the actress's name is Autumn Russell, and apparently she is still around in her 90s. She was the one with the senator, and JJ was telling the senator to please don't flaunt this kind of thing. It's going to get you in trouble.
Right. The senator has the beard. She's with the other guy. And yeah.
It's weird that, you know, she looks a lot to me, she looks a lot like Janet Leigh. And Janet Leigh was apparently one of the producers of this movie. It's weird that Leigh didn't like pop in for a cameo.
Yep. Well, that's part of what ensured Tony Curtis would get the role.
The braids may be Jersey City, but the clothes are Trina Norell or whatever. It's
very nice.
It's something I say all the time.
The other, well, another woman we haven't mentioned is the wife of the other columnist that...
Oh, what's her name?
Yeah.
Joyce?
No, Loretta.
Yeah, that Sydney tries to blackmail.
The other columnist, who besides Steve Dallas is the moral center of the movie. Yeah, oh God, we're doomed.
And the idea that, you know, he goes, you know what? I have enough moral fiber that you're not going to corrupt my column. I'm going to tell my wife about my affair myself.
That was a nicely done scene.
But it was a nicely done scene.
Done, sure.
And she was sharp. She was amusing. You know, she's still kind of treated like an object, but...
But she has a personality of her own. I mean, she's sitting there looking at the racing form, and she's, you know, the impression is left that their marriage isn't particularly close because she's occupied by what she's occupied by, and he's presumably looking for material for his column. And then we found out that he's had dalliances, and she's continuing to look at the racing form. But she does that. He tells her the truth, and she does that pivot, and she basically says, good on you, Leo.
That's the one good thing you've done in years or something like that.
And it completely wrongfoots Sydney, which is great.
I liked JJ's secretary. I feel like, you know, she works for a cruel guy but is not cruel herself.
Yeah.
She was an interesting... You can tell that she is very sympathetic.
She is sympathetic, and she's not in the sense of, like... Oh, she's going to change him by any means. She 100% has his number. She's probably very good at what she does, is the impression I get.
Yeah, she probably just stays out of his way. But she has that great moment where you can tell she is looking at Susan with great sympathy, but she also knows that if she wants to keep her job, she's got to keep her mouth shut.
Oh, Sam Levine. I love Sam Levine. I loved him in the Thin Man films as Lieutenant Abrams. I loved him in the original Broadway cast album of Guys and Dolls because he was the original Nathan Detroit. And he plays
who he is.
Steve Dallas's uncle lawyer.
And Steve Dallas's manager?
Agent. Yeah,
lawyer,
manager,
agent, lawyer. And, I wasn't quite sure what
part of why you don't recognize him is he's shaved his mustache. We always see him with the mustache.
Wasn't he wearing a hat most of the time?
He's got
too,
a hat so most yeah. of the time. But yeah, as soon as he opened his mouth, I'm like, oh, that's Sam Levine. Okay. And yeah, he's great.
Leave it to us to always get down to the nitty gritty with the character actors. I love that.
I want to raise something, and I'll address this to Mr. Datinga, who, along with me, is old enough to actually have worked in print media. One of the things that takes me right out of the movie is when you see the newspaper with JJ's column on it, and not only does it have the little illustration, but it has the giant picture of JJ. And I'm thinking, oh, God, that would never happen. Those are column inches you're sacrificing.
That's precious.
That's right.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
You'd either have one or the other, but not both. And so
newspaper pictures are not only very tiny, but they're very terrible. They're low res usually, and they just look awful.
And here it's Burt Lancaster's 8x10.
Great big glossy, mug.
Right?
You could read that as like a show of his power, of JJ's power.
I read that as someone who, we don't know how newspapers work.
Yeah, I will say, I did pause it and read the, read all the story. Whoever wrote it did a pretty good job of making it sound like the way he speaks in the movie. And they went all out. The whole thing actually reads plausibly. I love the ads.
No, if you pause and read the column, at least at the beginning of the movie, when Sydney's looking at it in the all-night diner, it is nonsense. It is just bits and pieces that have been clipped and randomly pasted together.
It's,
but if you pause and read, it's not, though, because they reuse passages of text and suddenly he's talking about different things, like in the middle of a sentence. I love it when people bother to, you know, mock up actual articles in film and television. So I always pause to try to read the stuff. And in that case, I was like, oh, man, you had, and they linger on it long enough for you to spot that. I was really disappointed that they didn't bother to actually, in this beautiful close up, write a legible article. They're just like, no, let's copy and paste bits from someone else's column and randomly fill them in to make it look good.
They certainly didn't expect anybody to have the capability of freeze framing it and reading it.
Really?
I know, it's shocking. It's shocking.
Now, do you think JJ's eyeglasses should have gotten their credit? Because they're
the character. Yeah. The eyes of Broadway.
I have read a couple places that the director put Vaseline on his eyeglasses.
Yes.
James Wong Howe did that, yeah.
And it had the effect of making it hard for his eyes to focus. And that may have
been. It's so he would always have a blank look.
Yeah.
And so that it affects his stare to make it more
scary.
I think it's very effective. Like I think Lancaster, even though he was a good-looking man, even without the glasses, I think he could have still been intimidating and scary, especially because of the way he was shot and the way he was performing. But I think the glasses help. They sort of give his face a just this aspect of, and again, because it's shot from below and because of the style of the glasses, it's an appliance on his head. You know, he looks a little alien in that regard.
My least favorite part of IMDb trivia is this guy was almost cast in this part, because, you know, it's generally nonsense. But the Hunsucker alternative casting things range from horrific to ridiculous. And apparently at one point Hume Cronin was considered because he kind of looked like Walter Winchell. No, that's nuts.
Yeah.
And the more plausible one is, oh, we want to get Orson Welles.
Role. Is the one I read.
Yeah,
I,
Orson Welles is that probably was seriously considered, but apparently what happened was Burt Lancaster was in The Trapeze Artist with Tony Curtis, and he said, oh, he should play Falco, and I guess I'll do Hunsucker then.
Well, and Lancaster was going to produce it. They probably needed an independent producer in order for it to happen, and Lancaster was producing. I think this is kind of on brand for the kind of thing that Lancaster was producing at that time.
Yeah, he was one of the producers who originated adapting it, and he was angry before it was released, they watched it and he said, you've destroyed our company. And he was furious at his producing partners, which is wild to me. I'd like, how do you watch this and go, oh, you've ruined our company? This is a great film.
Yeah, that seems odd.
You made it every step of the way. You are in most of it.
I was going to say, right. It's not like, oh, well, I just saw this thing and I have no connection to it. You're in, except for the first 20 minutes, you're in almost all of it.
It's so bizarre.
But apparently one of the early test screening comments was, don't change a thing, just burn all the prints.
Right. Well, that was from civilians who were like, what is this I'm watching right now? Well, friends, thank you so much for talking with me about Sweet Smell of Success from 1957. Again, the Criterion Blu-ray, well worth your money if you want to buy that. Or you could go to Amazon Prime, where apparently the HD transfer is really awesome. You can keep up with this podcast at theincomparable.com/LTS. You can subscribe. You can also email us at lts@theincomparable.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra, or follow me personally on Twitter at Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a very different movie, the musical Kiss Me, Kate, from 1954. Bye now.